Okay, let's go and get started. I'm gonna do a couple of. Well, actually, we'll let you guys go ahead and start. Okay. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, I'll kind of go start babbling.
Hello, everybody. Do you guys know what the CCSS is? Can I get some nods? Yeah. So it's the Computer Science Society. It's the society. Well, it's a student society. We run events. We run events. And what else do we do?
We sell Arizona and we do fun things.
Yeah,
and we have academic services.
We have your interests in mind. So the CCS elections are next week, and we have some candidates that are running. Me, Lindsay, and Connor. So, Lindsay.
Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm running for CCSS. I'm not so much of an idea come up or what, but there's already a lot of those. I'm a doer, so people pass me ideas, they get done. That's just.
So I'm running for a director position. My name is Christian Delahousse. In the past, I've run a few events. I've had an entrepreneurship event. Next year, I'd like to run a few more events, like I'm thinking of Agile Games, Mock Interview Puzzle Night, or Mock Interview Night, and a Mock Puzzle Interview Night, and a few other things. So that's what I'm going to fight for if you guys put me in.
I'm Connor Hillen. I'm currently first-year representative. I've been working with the CCSS all year to try and just get events going, get feedback in. So I really know how to, like, take in feedback and push that to the CCSS. So I can definitely bring back your feedback. I am going in hoping to get a bunch of academic services running through the CCSS, so academic workshops to help each other just, you know, what you wish you learned, kind of get people in upper years to come down and tell you things that you can expect in those years, get all sorts of events running, and just use the CCSS to its maximum potential. So, Connor Hillen, if you want to vote.
So, are you guys actually competing against each other?
We're not on the same, it's, yeah, well.
There's 7 positions, there's about 11 people running.
Okay.
And
so
you
like
can vote.
Mini
parties.
We're not on the same ticket. We're
no.
Kind
it's
of
really just the first 7 people with the most votes.
Yeah. And you can vote. You can vote at vote.ccss.carleton.ca.
Is
starting next Tuesday, you can vote at vote.ccss.carleton.ca.
Are you doing it by IP address, by MAC address?
I think it's by student ID.
By student ID.
School of Computer Science is doing authentication for us, and they'll verify that you are registered in computer science.
Brilliant.
So, Christian Delahousse, Connor,
Helen,
and Lindsay.
Lindsay Banks.
Thanks. Lindsay Banks.
Yeah.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Running for president.
If,
no.
If anyone else, yeah. If anyone else wants to give any sort of things, I'm happy to get the beginning of the class. That's fine. So what? One little side thing. People are making a joke about security of the web app. Notice, as a voting app, using authentication of the SCS. Well, I guess it's actually not CS, SCS, but My Carleton One unique identifier. That's actually pretty reasonable, but there is a major trade-off in doing that for an election, which is what?
Now the electoral
privacy. Your votes are all associated with your name. So, yes.
So, in that sense, I'd like to point out that the School of Computer Science verifies your identity as a computer science student, and they only
sent
to CCSS some
token. Right, no, I'm not saying that it can't, I'm not saying the application cannot be constructed in such a way so that certain information is not there, but you note the application has to be designed to specifically forget things.
Yes. And
from
the user's perspective, we have no way of knowing that.
You have no way of knowing that.
We still have knowledge of becoming after us.
Yes, but when you present a vote, you ID, and then you go into a voting booth. In the voting booth, you are isolated from everyone else, and you do what you want. So that there's a disconnect between the vote. And so if you look at secure online voting, what you typically see is how do you reconcile these two things? And it's not such an easy thing because, you know, nobody knows on the internet if you're a dog or whatever. You know, there's a famous New Yorker cartoon about that. But anyway.
So well, a couple of things. I want to talk, get a little more cross-site scripting about cross-site request forgery. Before getting into those things, though, I wanted to talk about something that I saw on Ars Technica today, which actually was, I thought, very relevant to this class. And before talking, it's related to Apple's iCloud service. But before talking about that, I want to ask you a little hypothetical question. Let's say you have, let's say you have at home, you have a little application with a database at home. And let's say you make, and then let's say you want to share it to your laptop from your desktop at home. So let's say you put it onto Dropbox. And now your database for your, for this is now, for your, what did I say the database was for?
No.
Let's say it's for my recipes. Okay, so I've got some recipes in there, I've got some things, or maybe it's my CD collection. Something silly. But I've got this database, it's sitting sitting on my desktop, it's sitting on my laptop. Both the files are synchronized via Dropbox. For those of you, if you all know, everyone here knows how Dropbox works, right?
Yeah.
Is anyone not, in terms from a user perspective, not a technical perspective.
And you're afraid about
that. If anyone has a question, I can explain what Dropbox is. So you've got Dropbox, I'm doing this. Let's say I go off on a trip, I make some changes to my CD collection, I buy some CDs, I put it in there, and then I don't have network connectivity during my trip. And then I come home and I start making changes to my home database. And then I connect my laptop and it starts syncing to Dropbox and my desktop starts syncing to Dropbox. Now they have slightly different versions of my database. What do I do to reconcile them?
Throw the whole thing out and start over.
The easiest way to do it is pick one. You pick one as being good, and the other one you trash, and you maybe manually look at whatever changes you did and copy them in.
Can you look at timestamps?
Well, you can look at timestamps, but the fact is, they both have new information that the other database doesn't. Right? You know, one has the local changes, you're doing some cleanup, the other one has some new things you entered. They're two different versions. Now, like, if this was a text document of some kind, you could, like, if you're looking at Git will take care of this automatically. It will merge the files, typically, and if you have changed different portions of the text file, the changes will get merged in. Will this happen if there's a database that you're doing this with? It will not. And in fact, if you try to rely on something like Dropbox to automatically synchronize your files, you're asking for things to get corrupted in a very bad way and lose everything that's in your database. So, it doesn't matter. Even if I just added records to one place and added records to the other place, a database is not a data structure that can be automatically synced by most sync services.
No, correct. But you can go through the records.
Oh, I'm not saying you can't manually reconcile it. I'm not saying you can't open each database and copy records back and forth.
No, not
Now you're talking about saying how you would do this automatically. Okay, so we'll get back to the second. But
right, so short of implementing a strict business process whereby you only have it open on one computer or the other, and before you edit it on either computer, you first sync and make sure you get the latest version and then play with it. As soon as you're out of that script, then you're in trouble.
So, basic rule of thumb. Do not put databases on file synchronization services. This matters because some of you might be trying to put things in Dropbox. Don't put your entire home directory into Dropbox. Don't do things like put your browser profile in Dropbox. Don't put your email profile in Dropbox. Bad. Very, very bad. Because the system has no way of dealing with conflicts. And
and the conflicts will be between different databases on it. So maybe one of them are changed, other ones they'll do different versions. It's like, no, you're asking for data loss. Not today, not tomorrow, but that one time when you really needed it to kind of synchronize things, it's going to trash everything. And that's the worst kind of thing. So why I'm mentioning this is because Apple is in really big trouble right now for this kind of issue. Now, they aren't that dumb. They're actually quite smart. Because as part of iCloud, they offer a number of synchronization services. One of them is document synchronization, which is Dropbox, which basically means they have a web app in the cloud, and they have local apps, and they send them up to the cloud. The cloud is supposed to have the server is supposed to have the central copy, the synchronized one, but these local ones can get out of sync, and so it uploads copies, and if there's parallel updates to the same file, it stores both versions on the server, and you have to decide which one you want, or you have to do your own conflict resolution. So that's what Dropbox does. iCloud does that fine. But it also has other things. And the other thing is this thing called Core Data, which is supposed to let you do synchronization, well, do this sort of thing, but with databases. And it doesn't work.
Any type of database?
Well, they have a specific data model, we have a database, but it's supposed to be for general applications being able to reconcile this database. And the idea is that you do updates in one place, and you do updates in another place, and then you'd play back, so you'd maintain a log of the updates you've done in different places, and it would play them back in the appropriate order, all back to the same database, when they all come back online. The trouble, you can get this kind of working, and that's what they've done to get kind of working, but there's enough corner cases of intermittent connectivity and stuff that essentially every developer that's tried to use this finds it's flaky. And now it's easy to pile onto Apple and say, oh, look how dumb they are, we should just go with Dropbox or go with Google stuff and say, but they're offering a service no one else does. No one else tries to offer a general database synchronization facility. And there's a reason for this. Because it's really hard. Anytime people do database synchronization, they do it application-specific database synchronization, so they know the exact semantics of it. Like, for example, a lot of you probably use browser synchronization. So that means your browser sync. So it means my browser state on one machine, one machine is the same as that. So my phone, my tablet, my desktop, it's different desktops, it's all synchronized. Those are using database synchronization mechanisms, but application specific. One's designed for Chrome, one designed for Firefox, for their particular kind of data. Apple was trying to do this in a general way and say it would just work. It doesn't. It just kind of works. And I'm guessing what it is there's some that. I'm guessing as much as anything, it's a documentation problem, I will bet you. I bet you it's not necessarily that the back-end service doesn't work. I'm sure there are some bugs, but I think what's happening is they probably have certain rules for how you construct your databases and organize your data so that the synchronization process will work automatically. And as long as you follow those constraints, everything will work. But mapping those constraints onto your application is probably non-trivial and probably not appropriately documented. And so developers construct their databases certain ways, have certain kind of data models, rely on the automatic syncing, and then blam! It's corrupted. You lost everything.
The Apple engineers aren't talking with the Apple documentation.
It's the developers. I mean, they may say, well, but look, we told you, it's right there. But it's not, I'm guessing. I haven't looked into detail, but of course, Apple's main applications don't seem to use the service. At least not publicly. But although, at least none of the major ones. So.
Are we
this,
talking to iCloud? Because I mean.
Yes, this is iCloud. Yeah, this is part of iCloud.
Contacts.
Yeah, but it's not. But that's CalDAV. They use like CalDAV. See, that's the thing. There's all these domain-specific database synchronization protocols. That's effectively what an email like IMAP is. is a database synchronization protocol specialized for the email data model. So, synchronizing databases in a disconnected fashion is a hard problem, and only expect to solve it in an application-specific way. And when you're doing that, you're still probably going to mess it up. So only do it if you really, really have to. This is why having an always connected online presence is much, much easier. You just have a central database. You just go to it. It does everything. It's the canonical version. You can cache versions, but you never consider those completely trusted. You always go back to the server. This is not a small problem. And I'm mentioning it here in this class because this is the core of when you look at web apps and we're looking at clients and servers and synchronizing state and stuff, you get this notion of, I don't want to fall completely to the web model. I don't want the server to be canonical. I just want to work in the client and work independently and then just, you know, work disconnected and then synchronized to the server. You can kind of get that working, but disconnected operation is what I'm talking about here. You have a local database. You have the server's database. They get modified things because it's, of course, not just one client and one server. It's the server and potentially many clients. Same user logged in many times. All at the same time, all in parallel, updating things.
With different servers.
Yeah, that too. I was looking at the comment thread in Ars Technica. It was really funny to see the mix of like, okay, that person has a clue. Oh, that person really doesn't have a clue. Nope, no clue. Oh, they have a clue. I mean, it's like about a fourth of the comments are from people who have a clue.
That's pretty impressive.
Which is not bad. What?
Maybe Ars Technica, but yeah, just in general.
Yeah, that's actually on the higher side. But I'm saying is, but still. I mean, what I'm saying is, when I say not a clue, I'm saying they don't understand the problem. They say, Apple should just buy Dropbox. They solve that part of the problem. Google does this all the time. Google does this for their own services, not for anyone else's.
Yeah,
they
also have to,
And then they shut down the services, yes. I got a feeling this Google Reader thing is going to be
It's great.
Huh?
I was thinking about it. I think it's great at shutting down because there are other amazing readers that are suddenly coming to the forefront. Everybody uses Google Reader.
I'm not saying that. I think it's going to be a long. I think it's be good for the RSS market, but I think that the long term, it's going to be a change. I think it's a bit of a change among the certain class of people of how they regard cloud services. Because there's a certain, I don't know how many of you have been using Google Reader, but it's like, and this is why people start getting interested in things like disconnected operation. I want it to be present everywhere, but I want it to work like a desktop. I want to be able to be just have my own thing. But then I want them all to be the same.
As far as Google shutting down Google Reader, I wonder if Google will change their ways, having heard what people said about it.
I don't know.
They don't typically do that. What do you mean by a class of people changing the way they think about web apps?
Because the people who were using Google Reader were tech-savvy, early adopters, jumping on to the next thing. And what you see a lot of people going like, wow, maybe I don't want to use that next thing from that next product. I don't know how long it's going to be around. If I actually like it, I'm going to be screwed because it's probably going to go away. By the way, this is one great thing about open source software, of course.
That's exactly why I didn't go to Google, and I'm still on Apple.
Do you all realize, like, I have... How many of you have... Well, all of you aren't this old. Most of you aren't this old. But I literally have documents that were created... Yeah, 20 years ago? In like, LaTeX and stuff? That I can still interpret, read, format exactly the same way as I did when I made them. I mean, they will look exactly the same. Because LaTeX is a document preparation. I mean, I can take my LaTeX documents from 20 years ago, early 90s, and
run them through a modern LaTeX compiler, which is basically the same compiler, by the way. It hasn't really changed in 2 decades. And get the same output. I mean, that's because it's open source. You can't do that with, like, 2 versions of Word back.
It's also because it's good. If LaTeX had been really, really bad, they would have fixed a bunch of things, and that would have broken your...
Well, it's open source, right? So you
keep the old version.
Yeah.
I just keep the old version. Oh, also, I made a mistake last time. So I was talking about cross-site. So cross-site scripting and cookies. How do you do cookie theft? So one way to do it is you can do some stuff with servers, but there is a way which you can't do so much right now, but you used to be able to do a lot, which is that you could read the cookie directly from JavaScript. You know what the cookie was? It still is, it's document.cookie. You know, it's just the cookie, you know, it's just a reference, it's a big...
Did they remove it?
Document.cookie still exists. However, for authentication to cookies, cookies that you care about, you can't access them from JavaScript anymore. And that's because they are marked as HTTP-only cookies. So if you want to use session cookies that are protected against cross-site scripting attacks, you want to use HTTP-only cookies, which is supported by basically every modern browser. But that means you have to know about things like HTTP-only cookies. So how would you get these if you didn't know about it?
Middleware.
Turns out that, like, if you use Connect and Express and everything, when they do session cookies, they use HTTP-only cookies automatically because that's the right way of doing it. Again, this is one of the things about doing modern programming, particularly doing something with the web, is you want to use those existing libraries that solve these problems because they solved it mostly right. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm saying you're going to do a worse job. Just be, it's a simple matter of time. How much time are you going to spend implementing your session stuff? How much time did they spend implementing their session stuff? How much time did they spend thinking about the issues? How much experience do they have with that problem? If that's not the core problem you're trying to solve, don't try to solve it. So that's...
I think I can really improve the wheel.
Because I would much rather write my own code than read somebody else's code. So now let's talk cross-site request forgeries, CSRF. So cross-site request forgery it can interact with cross-site scripting, but it's a completely separate thing. And what it has to do with is session management.
So is it XSRF?
Yeah, they use both. Oh, wait. I did. Oh, my God. They're both the same.
I'll save equal sign.
Yeah. Again, bitten by the darn web terminology. New stuff. So with cross-site request forgery, it's a problem with session management. It's about the server getting confused about what the session is on the client. So, here are my 2 browser windows. And here's my bank. So here is the bank's web page. Here's the attacker. So if you're at the bank's webpage, you're logged in, right? So there's a cookie here. You're authenticated here, and you're all set up. You can do your banking transactions, do whatever you want, change, you send those messages, So what happens when you send a message here? It goes over here and it includes the cookie.
And so you go, okay, the cookie's going along. I know that bank says this is all right. I can do this. Now, with a cross-site request forgery, you don't steal the cookie. But what you do is you just send a request to the bank. Now, you're making a request of this domain, of the bank's domain. So this cookie is going to come along too and be given to the server. And so it's going to see, while you're logged into your bank, the attacker tries connecting. So if they send a message, let's say there's an HTTP POST command that they construct to say, transfer $1,000 to another account. That POST command goes over here, and it goes like, oh, is that allowed? Oh, does it have the right cookie? Oh, the cookie's included. Because the cookie's associated with the destination domain. The session, when you have cookies for designating session state, it's a global browser thing. They're not specific to the tabs. And so, in a classic web application, you can't tell the difference on the server between these two requests. This one was generated by the bank's web page, and so it should be trusted. This one was not. So,
tell me that browsers now sandbox that.
So, this is the problem. How do you stop it? How can the server know the difference between these two things? Mm-hmm.
Generate a unique ID.
See if it's global.
Oh, yeah.
See, the whole thing is, it's this, cookies are global. So, one thing, of course, is to have the cookies be per window.
You have
a session cookie. So what you can do is, now if you do things right, you can have session cookies, which are specific to a browser window. From the internals of a browser, they're the same thing. It's just those UIs. So you have separate tabbed windows. They have cookies just associated with it. So this connection can't happen because it won't go into the reference here. But that's not a completely general solution because there are sometimes you have multiple windows associated with an application. So the general solution for protecting this is you want the server to have a way of knowing where did the page that sent this request come from?
In a way that can't be faked.
Right. Now, what you're doing is you're depending upon the web browser from being a trusted source of information, which in general you can rely upon.
As long as the bank doesn't put any attacking ads in.
Well, yes. That's where cross-site scripting and cross-site request for it. That's actually why you want the server-side solution, is to protect the cross-site scripting version of this. But if it's more mixed in with there. But there's a bunch of information the browser sends to the server in the headers. Some things like, what's your character set? What's your browser version and things? There's all this stuff. One of the things it also sends is the... Okay, can I get the spelling right? Because it's misspelled. In the standard, the refer header, as I recall, does not have the correct spelling. Is it?
No.
Yeah, and so, yeah, is this the...
That's the incorrect spelling.
Okay, yes, good. Okay, so now, in other words, this is the one you'll have to use. But that's not how you spell the word refer. But. So the refer, so what does the refer field say?
It says, where did, what is the web page that had this link? So when you when you're on, say, Slashdot or something, or Reddit or something, and you click on a link and you go to some other website, the other website knows you came from Reddit or Slashdot or something because of the referrer header. You were referred to this website by this other page.
That's how they do click-through ads and stuff, right?
Yep.
It's
used by...
Well, it's used by... It kind of depends. I'm not sure exactly what kind of ad you're talking about there. But basically, whenever you go to a web page, it's like, oh, you came from here. They generally know where you came from because they know the referrer header. Now, if you use... Now, because this is a very clear potential privacy issue, there are various proxies and other things that go around and strip this header from your HTTP requests. So, in general, this is there, but it's not always there, and particularly for certain organizations, they'll be proxying it and getting rid of this. So you think, oh, the referrer header would be a great thing for the bank to look at, because then it could see where it came from. But it's not always present. So, and the reason why it's not always present is because people care about privacy. They don't want to know, they don't necessarily want to tell where they got this link from. They just want to say, I'm just visiting your page. Yes? Sure. How it uses the cookie? So all it's doing here is it's making an HTTP request. So when you give an HTTP request, you're giving it a URL. The URL is of the bank. It's on the page of the attacker. When you make this request to the bank, the browser says, what cookie should I include with this request?
It might be helpful to draw a bigger box around them because they're in the same browser.
Yeah, this is all in the same browser. So there is this general cookie store. And the cookie store, by default, is not associated with any window. The cookie store is associated with the entire browser. So any tab or any window accesses the same cookie store. And because it accesses the same cookie store, it just looks to see, oh, this cookie is for the bank. It belongs to the bank's domain. So whenever I make an HTTP request to the bank, I send its cookie along. Very helpful. So what I'm saying, in modern browsers, there is a global cookie store, and there is a per window, per tab cookie store, which can be used for session cookies, so that they cannot be accessed in this way. But still, you then are subject to attacks within the same page. Like, for example, if you included JavaScript from an ad or something like that. And that could potentially do this sort of thing. And so, is that clear now?
Yeah.
Okay, so this referrer header is normally put in there so you know where the page came from. If the server could look at the referrer header, it'd be able to say, oh, the attacker page referred it. That's wrong. Should have come only from my bank page. I'll reject anything coming from somewhere else. Or, if I'm uncertain for it, I might ask you to log in again. This is why oftentimes just before doing a purchase or something else, they will ask you to re-authenticate. You go like, I just did. Why am I having to type my password again? It's to prevent these attacks. Yes?
Just to be clear, the per tab, per window store would protect you if you logged into your bank and then also just went to Gmail at the same tab, right? Or the attacker site?
No. It's per tab. It really is like every time you get a new window.
No, but like in the same tab.
Oh, you
then
visit another page.
Without clicking log out.
Because no one ever logs
there. Yeah. I think it's actually not just per window, but it's like when you leave the page, it all gets erased. But I'm not sure. See, these are the kind of things that mostly happen.
Set of domains.
Huh? What?
So like for contiguous access to the domain.
Like the idea is that when you close the window, it's supposed to get rid of that state. But the trouble is you can go forward and back. But often when you go back, you've lost the state. Sometimes.
I find when I go back, I don't lose the state.
Because it
depends.
It often asks you to resubmit the form.
Once you resubmit it, it's going to be like, oh, you're resubmitting different stuff.
Yeah, but it depends. So the part of the problem with how you have to build a web app is not so much that browsers don't do the right thing, it's that they all don't do exactly the right thing. If you start reading the research literature in the issues that come up with these kind of cookies and things and cross-site request forgery and stuff like that, they come up, well, this mostly works in these browsers, this strategy. And this strategy works over here, but this one actually does this weird thing and carries it over and stuff. Like, all the scoping rules of where the cookies exist and for how long under what circumstances is implementation dependent. It's not part of the standard spec. It's more by convention. And it's not
what, huh? As long as the popular ones do it right, then.
Well, yes, but the trouble is you're making your web app. If you're trying to program your web app to be secure, in most circumstances, you can't rely on that. And also, it's not just the browser; it's also all these stupid proxies and other things that mangle things along the way. Yes.
Why can't you steal the referrer from another page?
Because you don't control what the referrer is. There is, the referrer is determined by where did the browser get this page.
So the browser sends headers that are not configurable by
that page.
The page.
Well, in general,
does
they aren't configurable.
Client send it, or does the server send
it? No, when I'm talking about HTTP headers, I'm talking about, this is from the HTTP request. When you send the request for a URL, you say HTTP get and give it a URL, it gives all those other things with it. As part of the request. And one of the things that gives you information on what browser you're running, gives information on what OS you're running, it gives information on your character set.
So what's stopping them from doing a copy and paste of that?
No.
Is it a post?
No, it's a get or a post. So what is the attacker have control over? Are you going to try answering this, or you guys have a question?
Well, I'm just curious. In Ajax, you don't have access to those properties?
You can't change them. I mean,
there must be extensions, though, because there's stuff that
you can add headers. Effectively, when you do a post, you're adding new headers.
Right.
You're adding new things, but you can't change the existing ones.
You could probably add a refer header, but the browser will probably cooperate.
Right.
Mm. The browser speaks last.
Yeah.
So the extensions that you can install to, say, put on your Firefox to make your system look like it's a...
That's modifying your browser. That's not in the web page.
So basically, short of rooting the system or rooting the browser, you don't have access to the...
Exactly. You can't control how the HTTP request goes out. You can't control those other things that come out. You can add things to it, but you can't change the other information that comes out.
So could you think of it sort of as a wrapper to the around the request that the page is sending? Like
exactly. Exactly. What the idea is that when you visit a mobile website, you're on your phone, you visit a place and it all of a sudden gives you the mobile version of the page as opposed to the desktop version. How does it know to give you the mobile version? It's because your browser tattled on you. It said what kind of browser you have. And the way it tells you this is by the headers that come after me. It sends the HTTP request, your HTTP get, the URL, and then there's all these options. It's a key value, key value, key value. And by convention, browsers are very chatty. They send all kinds of things. If you look in your web developer stuff, you can look at the HTTP requests. When you look at the HTTP requests, you'll see, whoa, that's all. I'm saying all that information every time I do an HTTP get, HTTP post, it's quite remarkable. And I'm saying one of the...
Your personality, your home address.
Yes.
I don't get how it handles proxies.
How does it handle proxies?
Yeah.
The proxies can rewrite the headers.
So how does the page avoid that?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is the referrer header isn't good enough. Because these tend to get stripped by privacy-preserving proxies. So you need another header. And so there is another header. Called the origin header, spelled correctly. The origin header is exactly like the referrer header, except it doesn't give the full URL that came from it. It just gives the domain. And because it just gives the domain, it's generally considered to be not so privacy things, and so that's
That is what you can use the bank, and that and modern browsers generally support the origin header. But again, this is all pretty low level stuff, and if you use the right middleware, it will keep track of the origin header and stuff like that. You won't be doing this sort of stuff directly. But this is, when you talk cross-site request forgery, it's not such a simple thing. It's because it's how sessions are built on top of the sessionless, the connectionless protocol, which is HTTP.
Can some window access the dome of another window?
Under certain circumstances, yes, but in general, no. You can have child windows and embedded iframes and stuff, and then you have certain access rules to your children. What, huh?
Aren't iframes being deprecated?
No, they're still very much there. Frames are being deprecated. No one does frames anymore. Frames are annoying. They're like, yeah, they get the different scroll bars and stuff. But iframes are very much there. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, say again, where are the origin headers sent from?
It's the browser telling the server,
okay,
where did this HTTP request, what is the origin of the page that made the request?
So even if the referrer header gets stripped, it's still sending that information to the server.
Right, and in general, the origin header doesn't get stripped because people know that it's not giving... Because when you give the full URL, there can be lots of little details. It can be your form things and other... So this is...
So it's the server strips the referrer header and sends the origin header.
No, I'm saying if there's a proxy server in between. So if there's some server in between that's relaying these things, then in general, those will not strip out the origin headers.
Okay, so...
But I'm not saying they couldn't. Who knows what they do? But the origin header is basically there for stopping cross-site request forgery.
Okay, so that's just another header that's in the browser.
Yes.
That is often just not strict.
Yes.
That the privacy people are like, okay.
We'll let that one through. And
or
that's,
you could like let it through if it's the same as the destination or whatever.
Right. Right, there are some ways of doing that. Like you just want to make sure the origin is your browser or something like that. But so I've actually published in this area, and we had some proposals for some of the stuff. I could tell you about that later. But it's a tricky area. So I'll talk to you about another problem here, which is not quite cross-site request forgery, but it has a sort of a similar flavor to it. Yes?
Sorry, so is that origin is the end of this? Cross-site?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the current best practice for stopping it, but
it's
still a little... Okay.
Doesn't HTTPS solve that?
It does. Sorry, you're right. The origin header does it, and then if you do HTTPS, you have a session enforced by your cryptographic credentials.
Okay, good.
So if you do things over HTTPS, you have true session semantics, you have cookies specific to that encrypted session, a lot of these problems go away. Which kind of says, well, why don't I just use HTTPS? Well, because you're paying for certificates, and otherwise you'd be...
And because if you're big enough, the computation overhead involved in HTTPS might actually be a significant amount, and so if you're somebody like Facebook, it might take you a few years to agree to the, okay, fine.
Computers keep getting faster, so it helps. And modern processors actually have cryptographic acceleration functions, so it's making it a lot less overhead, too. So let's say on your web application, in your website or something, let's say you host a really cool picture. A cat. Grumpy Cat. Okay, let's say it's Grumpy Cat. You got a picture of Grumpy Cat on your server or something, and then people around the world think, wow, I like Grumpy Cat.
This is it.
And you know what they start doing? They start embedding that picture in their web pages. But they don't copy the image into it. They just put a link to it in their web page. And it's popular now. And now, all of a sudden, your website's getting millions of hits for this image that was fine for people visiting your page, but now it's in all these other web pages. And you notice not only
are you not paying all this bandwidth? Those folks are getting ad revenue for showing your picture.
Sons of bitch.
Exactly. So if they had visited your page, you would have gotten some ad revenue. That might have offset the bandwidth cost here. But no, it's on their webpage. It's on their blog. They get the ad revenue. You get nothing, and you pay for them. You pay for serving Grumpy Cat to everyone in the world. How do you prevent this?
Switch it to a picture of...
Yeah. What?
Switch it to, gore or pornography.
Right. Well, that is one thing. It's like you notice this happening, and you go, damn it.
Sons of bitches.
You change the image, and now they're... Now like, oops, guess that was wrong. But that's not a general defense.
I thought you were
going to
say gentleman's defense.
No. That's not a general defense against it. So the web was designed for promiscuous sharing.
Yeah.
It was designed to just incorporate content from everywhere in the world, and it's just going to all be incorporated into your page. And I don't care that it comes from someone's server. It's like, oh, what does it matter and stuff. And now it matters a lot. So what you really want to be able to do is say, I got this picture. I only want this picture to be included as part of my web page. I don't want it part of anyone else's web page.
Check the origin.
Hmm? How do you do that?
Normally, serve the picture if the origin is your domain.
So.
Otherwise, send something that says, please go to www.mydomain.com to see this picture. It's really sweet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What? But then they'd have to embed your entire page.
Including the ad revenue.
Including the ad revenue. But you're right. Now, this actually gets into more serious things than this. Like, for example, banks and other things, like secure sites, worry about embedding their page in other people's pages. And there's a whole... It's called frame busting. How do you make sure your page is not embeddable in another page? And I think there are some standards on how to prevent your page not be embedded in another one, but I think it's all kind of... The frame busting stuff that I know of is all kind of ad hoc and not perfect. But, again, you should be looking at this going like, wow, there's a lot of little things to think about here. Yes, use the middleware. Use other people's solutions for this. You'll be much happier. Because they won't necessarily take care of everything, but they'll take care of a lot of these things, particularly these low-level issues.
Use trusted.
Yes. So which means ones, not just something random developed. You want ones that are well-developed, well-maintained. You can tell that there's lots of commits going to them. There's a bunch of people know about this. That takes a little bit of checking around. But the other thing I want to talk about was... Mozilla's proposal for CSP.
Too many acronyms.
So this is a new thing. This one is not completely implemented. I can say that I have certain biases against it because I actually published or co-authored a proposal that was competing with it, and that one didn't quite take off, and I still think it's better in many ways than this, but but this is what it is.
It's because you're not bitter or anything.
Well, it's... So the issue is... I'll explain what content security policy is, and I'll tell you what my issues with it are. But it's still something that you should probably use because it's now being standardized and everyone's using it, and we'll see. So content security policy is... So it doesn't deal with the fact of your stuff being embedded in the page, but it's trying to prevent your page from including code or data from sources that you don't want to. So the idea here is, I have my page, an attacker has managed to do a cross-site scripting attack on my page, and now they're pulling in all kinds of stuff, or they're now sending my information off somewhere else. So I want to draw, I want to control what network resources my web page can access. That's what CSP is for.
Sorry, who are you? You're a programmer here, not the...
I'm a web application developer. I want to specify, when my web page goes to the web browser, I want to control where that web page can talk on the network. In a classic web app, you wouldn't do this because you sent everything there. So you know exactly what it's going to do. Why do you have to put a policy? It's your code. In a modern web app, you do, because you're incorporating all kinds of other stuff into that web page. And you don't know. Like, for example, how do you make sure people aren't loading images from random websites in your in the comments on your web page? This is one way of doing it. I mean, the browser will make sure it won't load content except from the places you specify. So content security policy, I won't go through the details of it because they're kind of annoying for me. And one of the big problems with content security policy is the policy language it specifies is kind of baroque. It's very detailed. It lets you specify things like on a URL boundary and like say, this is the URL you can use for this and stuff. It's quite elaborate. So it means it gives you lots of control, but it's not something you incorporate directly into your page. This stuff goes into the HTTP headers. So this goes, this goes when your page is sent down from the server, it's not in the HTML. It's in the HTTP response headers that come with the page. So you can't actually set content security policy by just creating an HTML file and sending it there. You have to like change your Node app. And it would be, as part of sending the HTTP request, you would, an HTTP response, it has to send the policy along with it. It's part of the HTTP transaction. There's various technical reasons for why they wanted to do this. It certainly has certain performance benefits by putting it there, but specify a policy for this. Now, no one will be able to stick a link to Grumpy Cat in your comments. One problem for adopting content security policy in modern applications, in your application, is you can have no inline JavaScript. And all your JavaScript has to be external to your page. So, I think you can have stuff maybe in the header, in the head of the page, just not in the body, but basically it's no inline JavaScript. So you have to reorganize your page if you had inline JavaScript. A lot of people will have a little bit of inline JavaScript for handling button events or things. Now you have to make sure all that code is just a reference to external stuff. Inline's in general bad. So it's kind of best practices, but it's used. So the big difference, the proposal we had, instead of putting it in the headers, it was in a files. So you would just add files to your web server to do this. And the files were just very simply yes or no, and this has this on basis of domains, and this is all URL stuff. So. Less fine-grained, easier to use. That was our theory. So, how is this stuff? I've covered a lot of web security with last lecture and here. I can kind of keep going, but I kind of want to figure out how people are.
It needs its own course.
Oh yeah,
needs some degree.
Yeah. Well, the problem is it's so much of this stuff is not codified. I mean, the reason why I know whatever I do about web security is because I had a PhD student do this. And so she learned all kinds of things about this stuff that is involved in web, was sitting on the mailing list and arguing about content security policy in various details of the pros. But it's a very new area, and the things are not fully codified, and everyone doesn't even understand all the issues. Like saying that, what's your audience with the policy language? Who's going to be using this? And yes, I say CSP is there. I'm working on research for other policy languages and stuff. One thing I think has been underserved is how do you make better policy languages for web browsers to enforce things? Because you can't do everything by on the server by just making sure your code is correct. You can't do it. And where is the code running? A lot of it's running in the browser. So if you can enforce restrictions on the browser and the code running there, you can improve security. But how do you do this in a way where everyone creates a web page? You have to make it really easy. And you have to make it fit in with existing web technologies. So.
How does one get over the kernel error that your vectors may have induced?
Use middleware. This is why I'm saying really use... So the things that are going to bite you in a web application is fundamentally... It's first off, sessions, maintaining state, and then preventing... and then input validation. Those are the two big things. For maintaining state, there's already people who have written code to do that. For validating input, there is... Again, people have written code to do that, to make sure you don't, you know, to keep the parsers safe. If you use those, you'll be mostly good. But a level of paranoia is good because everyone messes it up. I can't say, oh, look, they build perfectly secure web apps. And the only thing I know of with that is that, okay, they build a pretty good web app, they seem good for it, then, oh, look, someone found a bug. That's why I actually have, in my research, I've focused on mitigation. I'm not interested in things that... There's this entire literature on scanners of your code. So have you all heard of...
Coverity? Or Fortify? Have you heard of these companies or products?
So, it's like a profiler, but for something.
So. Kind of, yes. You're on the right track. Fine. So there's this entire class of products that are being used in industry that are designed to go through your code automatically and find security problems. They're static analysis tools, is what they are. So instead of analyzing your code for syntax errors or analyzing your code for maybe performance bugs, they're analyzing it looking for security problems. So you get the exact model. Sometimes you buy the program and have it on your system and you run your code through it, or you maybe submit your source code to their web service or something, but it goes through, it finds a bunch of issues in your code, and then you go through and try to fix them. So first off, to what degree do you think these can fix your code? Maybe I'll find all the problems. How good are they?
Not very. There is no such thing as find all the problems.
So one thing you should remember always from from like computability and stuff is that these guys are trying to solve something that is not computable. Provably not computable. We can't analyze a program and decide whether it's going to stop. That's the halting problem. You cannot analyze a program automatically and tell 100% that it is secure or not. You can't do it. Because arbitrary properties of any program are not computable. You cannot write a program to do that. So these are trying to do something that in the limit case is impossible. That doesn't mean they can't find problems. It just means that they can't do everything. What they can, so how do they work?
They know of certain exploits or hacks that are common and they run them against your code.
Regular expressions. Yeah, well, regular expressions and other, actually they're policy language, I know, a bit more fancy, but they have these rules. The rules specify known patterns of bad things, like indexing past the end of an array for C is bad.
Like, these guys actually originally, like, Coverity, for a number of years, was publishing reports to the Linux kernel mailing list saying all the flaws they found in the Linux kernel. They used the Linux kernel as a test bed for testing their C error check. And they found a number of issues. And they helped, you know, and people fixed them. And But it's all for rules, for patterns for that they can specify, saying this is a known pattern for this kind of script. This is something that leads to a cross-site scripting vulnerability, so we'll look for that. But having all of that in, having all those rules that they've got now, that lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of rules in there. So what's the problem with that as a developer?
They don't have all the rules.
No.
So,
actually, these different companies in general, they give different reports. The rule sets are distinct, and they will find different problems. They'll find some overlapping, they'll find some different ones. But that's not, in per se, a bad thing. What I'm saying is, as a developer, you use one of these tools, how will this make your life difficult?
Well, first you're giving them all your source code, so that's...
Okay, well that, there's those issues. But you know, you use any commercial product you're potentially going for helping with your development process. That's not so much. Yeah?
Do you have a false sense of security?
Well, one thing is you run through it, oh, I got a clean bill of health, maybe my code is secure. But the other side is, oh my god, it just let flag 2,000 issues in my program. And then you start going through them, you've got 2,000 issues, and you find out 1,950 of them were fine. There wasn't a bug there.
Critical,
it was actually
issue,
secure.
One line if.
Exactly. They go through. It's like the rules are heuristics. They aren't, because remember, we're talking about security here. This is not correctness. There are things that can lead to problems that often are associated with them. But a developer has to look at each of them and check to see whether there's actually a security problem. And you have the problem in two ways. One is the program is wrong. The code is correct. The other problem is the programmer thinks the analysis is wrong and it was correct. They look at the code. They go like, wait, what's wrong with this? It's perfectly fine. We've been doing like this forever. And for like, they may have found like 100 instances or something where the tool in fact was wrong. Then they stop believing it. I say every one of these things, oh yeah, it's another one of those. It's fine. So what's one key rule of this? Is you can't just let the developers who wrote the code look at the reports.
Someone else.
It's
the managers.
Oh, well, it's not just the managers. You have to actually implement, you know, cross-checking.
Did you set rules? So, like, JS Lint, for example, you can add rules that omit certain warnings.
Well, you can prune it down to what, you know, maybe there's certain kinds of patterns you have in your code base that they trigger on, which, in fact, aren't security issues. So if you verified that, then sure, you disable those rules. And that's part of the tuning process they use to tune it to specific code bases. But the larger, it's a human problem, is that these things are not accurate enough to be completely trustworthy. But they do find things, and how do you distinguish between the times when it's right and the times that are wrong? And developers have an ego invested in saying that the tool is wrong. So this as a class of products, static analysis tools can be used. They're used now a lot for web development because, frankly, web code sucks. But it's also used in other domains.
These specific tools are used for web development.
What I'm saying is they have versions for.
Oh, okay.
And these are companies, and they have ones for. They have language-specific things, so they might have a Java one, a C one, a PHP one. Yes.
Security is about risk management, and risk management is cost-benefit. And so if you are a bank, you hire a security testers group of 50 people.
The trouble is security, if your app, if you have any data in your app that anyone cares about, I.e., in other words, if your app is worth building, you actually care about security. Because this is a chance of for data loss or theft. Or, I mean, it's just, that's, there's implicit trust in. So all I'm saying with these static analysis tools, you have to be very careful because they're not going to work perfectly. Developers won't like what comes out of them. They're going to piss them off. They'll stop believing it. And so now you may have found a whole bunch of problems and you won't change them. And also, you may start going through and fix all these problems. You're like, oh, now I've secured my application. The only real way to use these things is you have to change your entire organization's process.
Right.
These things get run, and when they find problems, you have to find out, how did that type of problem get into my code base? What is, you know, now we have to educate the developers. We have to maybe make our check-in tool. We have to do other things to say, what is the problem here, as opposed to just, fix what happens with the report.
You can integrate it into Git, so every time you check in your code,
No, but that's not what you want, because then people code to the tool. What you want this actually to happen is randomly, and you have to have it happen in a way potentially that the developers don't even see the exact errors. They say, it found a problem of this class in this file. Let the developer find it. Narrow it down.
So they feel proud that they found it.
No, see, you might, or maybe a function or something. There's a problem of this type with this function. You don't necessarily want to tell them, at least at first pass, what the line is. Because the program may have found one instance of it, and there may in fact be five of them.
Or zero.
And you don't know. So the developer needs to be thinking, okay, what kind of problem, what have I done, how have I misunderstood something? And changing their code. And ideally, you'd want to have someone else have it as a pair. One person gets the report and says, oh, look, I found this problem. And then they process it and then give it to the other one. It's kind of like how you do reverse engineering. The way you do reverse engineering is with a clean room. Everybody knows about this? I have a product I want to reverse engineer. If I have any one of my engineers look at the product actually, they are tainted. What they have learned directly from it, they potentially will transfer into the other product, and I'll be sued. So what you do is you have the one team look at the source code, or look at the hardware or whatever, and write a spec. That spec does not have anything proprietary in it. And then you have the other team take the spec and implement it, and they never look. And so that's what you really want to do for these kind of things, is you want to separate it out. Because if they start learning exactly all the quirks of these tools, it's better to treat them as more sophisticated oracles that scare the developers. Because then they'll try to be more secure as opposed to work around the stupid rules that it has. Because oftentimes you can fool these things by just like changing the formatting and adding your comment line or doing something like that, and then the warning goes away. So that was a bit of a digression, but that if you're doing web security and you're doing things in an enterprise, this is the kind of stuff that probably one of the things you want to do is some sort of static analysis. But just, but if I'm going to teach you how to do web security, a secure web program, I say, okay, we're going to take some of this, be paranoid about input sanitization, use some middleware and stuff, and I say, there's a reason why this is a really great research area. Research means I don't know how to do it right now. So anything else I want to tell you about security? Okay, databases. I'll do a last, that's a last bit. So we talked about SQL injection and, so again, it's the database is a parser. You're saying unsanitized input to the database. But from a network from an administrative standpoint, where do you put your database? How do you make sure the attackers don't get directly at the database itself?
Layer of abstraction.
Typically, databases are servers. They often
are web servers. Like, or they are listening on a socket and just taking commands. How do you make sure the attacker, like, okay, you can go through the web app and have and compromise it, but hey, if I can just get directly at your database, I have all your data. Now, one thing is you can say your database can have some sort of authentication mechanism. In general, databases are not secure against outside connections. Don't let anyone near them. So how do you protect them?
Password?
No, I'm saying the passwords don't work. I'm saying that's not good enough. Yep.
Infrastructure. So if you put your database on, say, the same LAN or whatnot, like IP specific or some sort of...
So we're typically talking about some sort of firewalling.
Right.
Some sort of firewalling, some sort of network topology, so that the database server is not directly accessible from the outside world. Now, I personally really hate this as a strategy because I now compromise your web server. I now, from that machine, now connect directly to your database. I don't bother compromising your web app. I get some other way onto your web server. I go from there, directly attack your database, and your database is defenseless. But honestly, I have not seen any databases actually really hardened against direct interactions, so. Real quick, wait, yes? No.
The other thing you could do is actually have an access layer on the database as well. So you have your web app that interacts with the database, but then you have sort of the input scrubbing module that sits in front of the database.
So what I'm trying to say is that there are access control layers for databases.
Right.
You can have users for databases, and people do, in fact, do that. But I've yet to hear of a database that really was hardened enough to be exposed to the general internet. They just aren't. They're not ready for it. And web servers, like you put Apache and other things, even a node, the basic node implementation, they're designed to be connected to from arbitrary things. And the big problem with a database is not even just them getting at your data. They can just mess with your database just by sending it bogus commands and just cause denial of services and just cause it to be checking things. I mean, in principle, you should be able to do it, but I've yet to see a database that's actually safe on the open internet. So try to isolate it and realize it's sensitive. And I will stop there.